Here's what you can look forward to in today's episode.
We're a smaller place then. And this opportunity came in with Kantar Millward Brown to do a pilot. And we could see the potential, and it was very much in the sweet spot of what our technology did then, still does now, of course. So I was involved in that early pilot. And it's interesting how much of the stuff that, you know, we kind of made up as how it should work for that pilot has still stuck to that day. I mean, obviously the science is vastly better than it was, and the norms and the sheer number of these tests we've done, like 35,000 plus. But some of the stuff that we did in those halcyon very first weeks or so is still really how we do it today.
Over the last decade, the market research industry has been disrupted. Our largest agencies are struggling to keep up as their customers turn to newer, faster, and cheaper data sources. Now, we are on the edge of yet another major market shift. Now is the time for us to reassert ourselves as the rudder of the brands we love. Thank you for tuning in to the Happy Market Research Podcast, where we are charting the path for the future of market researchers and businesses. Hi, I'm Jamie Brazil, and you're listening to the Happy Market Research Podcast. Today, my guest is Tim Peacock, COO of Affectiva. Affectiva spun out of MIT and is the pioneer of emotion AI. Prior to joining Affectiva, Tim has had extensive experience in all areas of technology, from startups to large organizations. Tim, thanks very much for being on the Happy Market Research Podcast today.
Hi, great to be here.
So maybe you could start out telling us a little bit about your parents, how they've impacted you and your current career.
Sure, I'd be happy to. It's going to take us back a little ways. My parents were born in England, and I'm English myself. And my dad's career relates to how I find myself in the United States. Dad was a hardware architect for IBM back in somewhat the early days of business computing. And he was working on a large project called System 360, which had the novel idea that software programs should be able to run on all different models of computers. And while working on that, which was really a major project in the United States, he was transferred over to New York, and that's how we came to this country. I think, you know, what I got from my dad was a sort of an engineering perspective into solving problems and looking at things as framing everything as a problem that needs to be solved. And that thus my interest in software engineering. It was much later, actually, that I discovered that he knew Fred Brooks very well. And Fred Brooks, for your older listeners, wrote the seminal text on software project management called The Mythical Man Month. So I found it interesting that I had a connection to Fred Brooks like that. My mom was very different. My mom was an executive secretary in New York City for many years, working for various presidents of companies, including Viacom, just before Sumner Redstone took over it. And what I really got from here was a feel for operations and how things actually work. So the presidents of all these very important companies would say, oh, you know, I can always get you tickets and I can do this and I can do that. But all that really meant is they would turn around to someone like my mom who knew how to actually do it. And so I think I acquired a fascination in you know, how things actually work and not just how people think they work. And so the combination of that engineering and operations has sort of led my career to where it is today.
I think that the operational consideration of how things get done is so powerful and is oftentimes demeaned inside of the organization. So people will see, you know, the CEO or you pick the big shot in the company, but it's actually the people that are underneath them that are providing that level of support that are really delivering on those promises. My favorite example of that personally is when I was I did an internship doing mainframe support back in 89. Super old, right? This is the vacuum tube type thing. Wang was a system. And I had these expense checks that I had, or expenses that I incurred doing the job, and I needed to get them reimbursed because, you know, I was going to eat or not eat based on the timing of those payments. And so I would bring a donut to the lady who did the accounts payable for expense reimbursements once a week. So it was about whatever it was back in those days, 10 cent sort of investment. But I actually got hand delivered my checks by her a week or two ahead of my boss.
There you go.
Right?
There
you go. It's all about figuring out how that system, the organization worked and could accomplish that objective.
Yeah. At every sort of startup I've been, I've always made a point of understanding, you know, who's doing the payroll, who's doing accounts payable. And obviously that function reports to me right now, but it didn't always. And I always look at people who would annoy the people who cut their paycheck. And I'm like, why would you do that? In what world would you annoy the person who's cutting your paycheck?
That's like the opposite.
Yes. Yes. As the donut story definitely shows.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think, you know, and it's interesting too, as you think about like sales, a lot of times if you have this like bottoms up, which most market researchers do, approach where we're starting with, you know, usually at a project manager level, and then as we get as the tools or services get traction, then you move up the chain, the value chain, ultimately of course to the hopefully the final decision makers, whether it's SVP of marketing or CMOs. You know, that sort of brand that you build at those early rungs is the absolute most critical, because it's the foundation of that, the potential size of the engagement that you wind up with.
Exactly. And what I found interesting in our run in market research, which, as you know, started in 2011, so Affectiva has been in this for about 7 years now, is it's not always clear, even in large organizations, where the decision maker is. A lot of our best stuff has started, our best relationships have started with somebody just, you know, authorizing a single little project and doing that well the first time and impressing someone and creating a champion in the organization is so critical for the future success.
So 7 years you've been in the space, and that coincides, of course, with your tenure at Affectiva. Did you help open up that channel or that market?
Yeah, but I was there. we all did, really. We were a smaller place then, and this opportunity came in with Kantar Millward Brown to do a pilot, and we could see the potential, and it was very much in the sweet spot of what our technology did then, still does now, of course. So I was involved in that early pilot, and it's interesting how much of the stuff that, you know, we kind of made up as how it should work for that pilot has still stuck to that day. I mean, obviously the science is vastly better than it was, and the norms and the sheer number of these tests we've done, like 35,000 plus. But some of the stuff that we did in those halcyon very first weeks or so is still really how we do it today. And it's been quite a ride.
So Kantar was, in a lot of ways, what opened up market research for you from an access point. Can you talk to us a little bit about the early days? I know this is going to precede your experience, I think, anyway, with Affectiva, but back at MIT. And then, so what was the original value prop? And then how did that help you move, you know, get a major customer like a Kantar?
Yes. Well, so yeah, as you've noted, Affectiva began, actually it begins before MIT at Cambridge University, where our founder, Dr. Rana El-Khaloubi, Rana's PhD thesis was about humanizing technology, which we will now come to call emotion AI. And her thesis demonstrated that a simple laptop computer with a webcam can measure the expressions and emotions on one's face. She was inspired to do that by Dr. Rosalind Picard's book, Effective Computing, which sort of created the field, actually literally created the field of effective computing in the 90s. And so when she got her doctorate, Rana went to work for Roz in the Effective Computing Lab at MIT's Media Lab. And what happened was the way Media Lab is funded is there's a large number of industry sponsors. And whenever they come in, it's sort of a demo or die experience for the researchers at the Media Lab. And Rana and Roz and their team would be doing that. And the interest from commercial side just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And eventually, they went to the head of the Media Lab and said, well, we just need more graduate students to do this interest. And he said, no, that's not right at all. You actually need more. You need to spin out. You need to be a commercial enterprise. And the interest was very broad, but market research such as from Kantar was there right from the beginning. And that was because emotions matter. I mean, the premise of our company is that emotions matter. We know from neuroscience research that the emotional centers of the brain kick in before the cognitive centers do in our decision-making process. They're both involved, but emotions get started. So anyone who's attempting to influence decision-making, loyalty, stuff like that, all the classic roots of marketing, knows that emotions matter. The question is how can you best measure them? And that is, of course, where Affectiva and Emotion AI comes in. So to get started, what happened was is that Cantor, Miller, Brown in particular, but a lot of other firms as well, were very strong on the cognitive side with sort of the classic surveys. And then there were various attempts to infer human emotion from how fast you answered a question and things like that. But very few people were directly measuring them. Some of the other technologies were around were EEG rigs, where you're putting, you know, an EEG rig on people's head. And those have come a long way in the years since, and people still do that. But Kantar, because their customers were global Fortune 500 companies, they needed something that could scale around the world. And our technology had that promise. And they basically felt if our technology really worked, which was the point of the pilot, that this is something that they would invest in and that we would scale together. And indeed, the pilot was very successful. The customer was really happy. They'd never, you know, really seen anything like this before, thought of it as a great advantage. And then the rest was, you know, a multi-year build out to work on all the different ways that people do market research in 87 different countries around the world.
Emotions matter. That is so in a modern context, that's more and more and more important. Like literally I'm seeing daily movements towards raising this banner. You think about the impact of voice on a consumer purchase journey, and unless a consumer connects to a specific brand name at an emotional level over the generic, then you've got a big problem, right? It is all about that. I'm going to call it the love connection, if you remember that show.
Yeah, I do. We're both showing our age a little bit, but that's okay.
Yeah, it is kind of sad. It's kind of sad. That's fine. So we hire younger people because they keep us relevant, I guess. I don't know. Are you seeing a surgence of adoption given that banner?
Yes, very much so. Just to come back to the brand point for a second, the one I always use is my own emotional connection. I mean, I'm a BMW driver. I was lucky enough to start driving them many years ago. And I have this emotional connection, as you say, to the brand, right? I don't think, oh, which car, you know, and do a whole search. It's like, oh, well, which of the latest BMWs I'm going to buy? And that's something that BMW has fostered in many ways with me. And that's the connection you're talking about. So are we seeing surgeons? Yeah, absolutely. And it's you know, market research was very much our breakthrough market. It took our technology worldwide. It gets us, you know, 7 million plus and growing every day to people's faces, powering our science and our norms. But, you know, it's spread out. We get inquiries all the time, and we're very much involved in things like the emotional aspects of automotive and the cognitive aspects of automotive safety and automotive cabin design, cabin experience, I should say. We've done some education. We've done some healthcare. We have people using our stuff for the online video recruitment. And then, you know, as I don't know if you made it to our recent, the second annual Emotion AI Summit, but one of the things we had on display there was a Pepper robot from SoftBank, and we announced a deal with SoftBank, and what we're doing there is we're enabling Pepper to understand emotion, and that's really getting into the bigger play, which is where, you know, Rana's, you know, dream really began back at Cambridge, which is that it's the human-machine interface. Machines aren't really going to interact with us smoothly and effectively, unless they understand human emotion. And our approach to that is to understand human emotion the way humans do, which is what we call a multimodal approach, where we don't consider just what you're saying or, you know, the commands you're typing on the screen, but what's on your face, what's in the tone of your voice, what gestures you're making at the same time. All modalities matter. That's how humans have been evolutionarily taught to convey and understand emotion. And we're going to enable machines to do that.
I mean, when you think about how much is communicated through spoken word versus body language, I kind of harken back to, I mean, this again, real early days, 96, I did my very first chat-based focus group. And in that experience, I thought it was interesting because I was able to get feedback in that, you know, I had transcripts of the discussion, but I felt like I lost a lot of the value because I couldn't read the room, so to speak.
Yeah, we like to cite some social research, which shows that about when you and I are in conversation, if we were actually face to face, in terms of the emotion that we were communicating to each other, we'd be getting a bit over half, 55% from face and gesture, 38% in terms of how we are saying things, and then the actual words in terms of conveying the emotion, only 7%. So you look at some of these technologies that are doing sentiment analysis. Now, they only have the text, so that's all they can do. But if you're doing sentiment analysis off text, you're actually reading about 7% of what the human was conveying. So it's a very tough approach. And so face-to-face, we learn to read it, and that's the approach we're taking with our technology, with our emotion AI.
Run us through those percentages again. So 7% is you know, words.
Is the words, yep. 38% is the... how you say the words, the prosodic features, and then 55% are visual. That's from a lot of that's what's on your face, but it also includes the gestures, body language, that kind of things.
So as your systems develop, will it be incorporating more and more of the whole person, the whole body?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think I may have mentioned to you, but I'll happily tell your listeners, we now have a voice capability in pretty late stage beta, and it's actually been delivered in the automotive versions of our SDK. So we're already getting everything off the face. All's room for a bit of improvement, but it's very well developed, and we're starting to bring voice into it, and we will add gestures, and we're also going to look at, you know, context is very important. When you and I are judging ourselves, we consider if we're talking across the table, it might be very different than if we're sitting at a sporting event, right? So context matters as well in understanding emotion.
Super complex, this whole reading emotion, I take it for granted, all of us as human beings take it for granted, somehow we just figure it out early and forget it's hard, right? The reading of this massive communication. I think of language as the hard part of it, but really it's the body language piece. And do you see that the body language transcends region and culture?
That's an interesting question, and we're just getting into the body language rather than the face. On the face, the expressions that a face can make are universal because it's dictated by the muscles. But when people make them, how often they make them, what they can mean, even sometimes a nod and a shake are different than what we think they mean in the U.S. So yes, very much cultural. So I'm not an expert in the body language itself, but based on head shaking and things like that, I would absolutely expect the meaning of gestures, the norms of gestures to be culturally specific.
Again, just kind of a broader context, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's go back a little bit to when you first started 7 years ago in this space. Terms of trade, was a transaction more of a one-off? So, hey, we've got a study. We want you to run your algorithms across these videos, and we're going to pay you for that.
It began that way. So we also had a separate product, a hardware product, which measured the galvanic skin response off your skin. We did a lot of custom research projects with people. So we were almost like a professional services, a research agency almost, where we were going, you know, can you guys do this and do this and help us analyze it? And it was very interesting. But it in terms of building a business, it was, you know, hard work. And it wasn't obvious how it would scale. I mean, there are definitely organizations that have made their mark as services organization. But we were looking for a more, you know, scalable software solution. And that's where particularly advertising testing inside of market research began to show promise because it was repeatable. And you could see, even if we were doing some of it by hand in the very early days, I mean, obviously we weren't doing the facial coding by hand, but in terms of delivery, we knew we could automate it. It was sort of straightforward software engineering with time and effort, we would get it. And that's why we ended up pivoting so hard into the focusing on that area for years, because it was repeatable, it was scalable. And so, you know, we had other partners, but Kantar became a significant partner, and the drive of them was to get them to standardize on that. instead of saying this was an option that a client could elect and their sales force could choose to sell, it had to have enough value, it had to have the price point, had to have the reliability, you know, had to have the case studies, you know, everything a large multinational needs to back it up, such that they would just include it in their standard products. And that was a couple-year effort, including, you know, Jamie, it's really interesting because we had this wonderful cloud-based system, and then we found out that in parts of Asia, you know, the market research was done offline. So we had to figure out how to do that. That was a bit of a surprise. But anyway, it was successful. They did standardize it, and along the way, you know, they went from, you know, commissioning projects to bulk ordering, you know, ordering batches to get a better price, and then eventually, you know, multi-year contracts that were based on it being standardized in their offerings. So it was quite a journey. I think one of the key learnings for us, which we've now taken forward to all our partnerships, was a belief in that the way we were going to win business was by having a collaborative, transparent partnership. That we were going to sit down and say, this is what our science can do. This is where the research can take us. But we're going to, if we don't have exactly what you need today, we're not going to make it up. We will tell you what we have, how it applies, and how we can get to what you want. And that can be a slower sale, but it creates really enduring partnerships. And I think tremendous value for Affectiva.
I love that. The every company that I've run into so far, especially in the market, 100% in the market research space, has been built on the backs of solid relationships as opposed to technology or services or price points, or you pick the USP, right? That is used. I want to hone in a little bit though on this, the early days compared to where you are now. And for our listeners, you guys are definitely the dominant player in emotion AI. So, but yet you didn't start there, right? That wasn't the initial, I'll call it, value prop. And as Paul Graham, one of the founders of Y Combinator, he has this framework for startup success, which is you start a business in a non-scalable way, and then you scale as the business, you figure out how to scale it as the business expands, right? And you're sitting on a lot of code and IP and smarts, et cetera. Is a big part of the value for the company in the norms, the thousands and thousands of hours of video that you have?
I think it is a big piece. I think norms married with expertise would almost be the formula. And we had early expertise, and we knew the value of the data. But it was partnerships that where we brought our expertise to bear that brought us in more data. So we did get into a virtuous cycle where simply by doing more business and delivering value, we brought more data in. That data improved the core science, the classification ability of the AI itself, and it also powered the norms database. So now we, you know, if you fast forward 7 years, and it's this, you know, 7 million plus videos of various people around the world, and then all of that powering norms, so that, you know, practically any country in the world that could come to us and say, well, is this the norm for chocolate ads in Morocco? And we could say yes, no, you know, that this is the norm, we know what it is. So we didn't have that all to begin with, right? To your point, we had to sort of scale with it and produce it very early on. It was clear that, you know, it helps to be an AI company so that you sort of appreciate the value of data inherently, but very clearly on, as you talk to customers, they'd be like, well, what does this mean? And we knew the value of being able to tell them what it means, not just in a normative value, but by doing case studies that can tie it to things that they actually care about, which is, you know, things like sales lift, brand recall, earned media, the stuff that really measures the effectiveness of advertising.
Yeah, which of course is a golden goose as you guys have continued to crack that nut.
Oh, just one other thing is, I was just thinking back to the you start with non-scalable thing. Yeah, and it's interesting to start. Absolutely, I totally agree with that. You have to find what the customer wants. And the chance that you're going to do that by building a scalable system first, and that's going to be exactly what they want, is very small. You have to be able to iterate quickly and get to them and be flexible. So you have really non-scalable systems. You have, you know, people, you know, dragging stuff into Excel or some data analytics program and producing plots and saying this is the way to do it. Is that the way to do it? And writing custom scripts. I think the first project we delivered for Kantar took us a week plus to deliver the results, and involving pretty much the entire team and how it should work and to do it. You know, and today it's a self-service thing that takes 2 minutes off in the cloud somewhere and we don't even notice it happening. But the key is you do the non-scalable stuff to get the feedback from the customers of what they really want. And when you're sure, you know, reasonably sure that you have what you want, that's what you scale.
Are you seeing on a go-forward basis, as there's other people that, you know, are going to figure out these or have figured out these algorithms or the AI or what have you, you know, the missing piece for them is actually the data to help inform their systems, right? Are you seeing that as part of the go-forward model, or are you thinking of that just keeping that as the moat around your IP?
Yeah, I think we view data more as a moat around the IP. I don't see us sharing it, certainly not in areas that directly compete with where we want to be. So I would view data more as a moat. I think that's just the answer there. We do collaborative academic research, so there's a lot of value in our data for analysis that we may never tap. So from a general knowledge point of view, we love to collaborate, particularly with academics, about certain things. I mean, one of the data points that came out of that is finding that in the U.S., and we know this for a lot of countries, but in the U.S., females tend to express about 20% more than males do in terms of advertising, reacting to advertising. So you need to obviously keep that in mind when you're analyzing an ad. But if you go over to the UK, males and females express at the same level and markedly lower than the US levels. So an example of what research can find and the kind of research we would do. And some of that is definitely done with academic institutions that are interested.
So are you selling directly? Obviously, you've got strategic partnerships inside of the market research agency world, but then are brands a major part of your customer base?
Well, that's a great question. And let me get at it from sort of a core strategy point of view and try to bring the answer back to you. We're an emotion AI company. We want to be the experts in understanding human emotion, whether that's for the analytics case like market research does, or more for the interactive case, say when you're talking to an Alexa or talking to your car or interacting with your car. And so our focus is on the emotion side. The full-fledged solution for a brand advertiser should, you know, obviously we believe definitely include objective scalable measure of emotion. It should include the cognitive side. And depending on what they're doing, it should include a fair amount of, or more or less, research assistance in terms of, this is a $50 million advertising campaign, then spend a lot of time with a team that does that every day and understand every last nuance of it. Or this is a quick run on the a quick digital campaign, and we'll see how it works, in which case do a quick test and move on. We want to be the emotion component. And so we're committed to a partnership channel wherein our partners, generally speaking, work with the brands directly, and we provide the emotion. Having said that, there are exceptions to that rule. Sometimes the brands themselves essentially are their own research agency, in which case we're happy to deal with them and work with them. And then, of course, we've worked with, I think it's 25% of the Global 500. So pick any name you want. I'm not necessarily going to be at liberty to share them. But when they want someone from Affectiva to get on a call and help them understand what the emotion traces mean, of course we're there for our partners. We do that all the time. But the key partner relationships with these larger firms are with the market research agencies, with the brands.
Yeah, because it makes sense on both sides, right? Because what you're doing is providing the data, and then what the researcher is doing, whether it's internal or external, is providing the so what, now what insight.
Exactly. And there are definitely other firms that have gone other ways, and that's fine. For us, it keeps us out of a channel conflict, right? We don't find ourselves competing with our partners for business. We always have exactly the same interest. And the analysis, even of a short 30-second ad, or if you're cutting a 60 to a 30, you know, intent matters, context matters. You can't just look at an emotion trace without the context and tell you it's a good ad. People ask that all the time. Was that good? Well, depends what you're trying to do a little bit, right? You know, what emotion were you trying to provoke? We can tell you what you're doing. We can tell you there are some general rules, of course, and those can be tailored to match exactly what you're trying to do. But deeply understanding what the brand's ad campaign is trying to do and then relating the emotional and indeed the cognitive data back to that, that's the role of the research agency. And that's who our partners are.
So I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about employees. We have three listener types, one of which are aspiring insight professionals. At your company, and given your broad experience, what do you see as the three characteristics of an all-star employee?
Absolutely. First, I'll just use four, so I'll cheat.
You can use as many as you want.
But because I'm going to claim there's a foundation layer, right? So you have to have the core expertise in what you're doing. So like when we hire an AI researcher, so take it as a given that they have to have an expertise in deep learning and the latest in AI research, right? So that's my given. You have to have the expertise in whatever thing we're hiring you for. But what separates the average machine learning researcher from an excellent one, or a software engineer, or the average biz dev person? And I would list three things. Passion, flexibility, and get things done. So going a little bit deeper into each of those. Passion is, it's a long haul in a startup, right? Where there's going to be great ups and there's going to be downs and there's going to be sideshows and all sorts of things. What brings you to work every single day to do your best, and those occasional late nights and weekends and messed up vacations and all that, is a passion for what you're doing. So understand what the company's doing. We're trying to humanize technology. And go there if you have a passion for it. Don't go to a startup if you don't have a passion. Don't go to a startup if you think, maybe they'll get bought in 6 months and I'll get rich. That does happen every now and then, but more often it's usually 8 years before you're an overnight success, right? So have a real passion for what you're doing. And it's that kind of, if that passion drives you, it'll make you stand out as an employee. And then, in contrast to very large companies, parenthetically, I worked at a company that got bought by IBM. So I've done several years at one of the world's largest. Flexibility. Yes, there's the core job you're going to do, but there's all sorts of other things. For example, we just put on an Emotion AI Summit a couple of weeks ago. Hundreds of people came to Boston, hosted by us, to talk about trust in AI, diversity in AI, and some very important general AI topics. And so, we had help and we spent some money, but everybody in this company did an amazing job of pitching in of things that had nothing to do with their jobs. You're standing around and we had to move some demos. Okay, it's a few blocks that way. Help us load the van up and things like that. But every day in a startup, it isn't just the trivial stuff like that. It's very important stuff like, you may not be comfortable on customer calls, but this customer needs an expert and you're the one who's available. So get on that call and help us explain what's going on to this customer. So passion, flexibility. And then finally, get things done. Don't be a talker. Don't sit back and hypothesize this or that. From researchers to engineers to absolutely everything, startups only create value by getting things done. So have a knack for getting things done. Get to closure. Get to finish. Deliver stuff to the market. Deliver stuff to the customer. And that all is based on people who get things done.
I interviewed a... I actually can't. I don't even want to say the job title because I don't want to hurt anybody. But this is such a great story relevant to especially your last point. Jamie Plunkett and I interviewed this senior level person. It was a really important, critical role, like a building block role for the organization. Guy looked great on paper. He left the office. It was an 8-hour interview, and we looked at each other and I said, he's checking all the boxes. And Jamie actually told me, he said, Jamin, this guy is going to say all the right stuff, but at the end of the day, he's not going to do shit. And and that's exactly right. It was like this sort of view of I'm going to create this facade of work as opposed to roll, you know, the adage of rolling your sleeves up and getting the work done alongside the rest of the employees. And then also, you know, the flexibility in that there is no task that's too small or too great for me to tackle. And even if I'm operating outside my comfort zone, I'm willing to suck it up and have that that uncomfortable customer call, right?
Yeah, I'm an old engineering guy, so I have a standard, you know, speech to new engineering managers who have the fortune or misfortune to work for me. And I say, you know, so like engineering management is about delivery, right? And so there's like two scales that I'm going to grade you on, two grade ranges, if you will, at the end of a project, right? There's one that sort of runs from A to B plus to C, and that's for projects that finish and deliver, right? And then there's another one that might touch, you know, B plus, yes, but it goes all the way into F, and that's for projects that don't. So don't have the really great excuses about why you didn't deliver or it couldn't be done. Just get it done. You have to get it done to get into that A range. That's what engineering is about.
That's 100%. And that's not just, it's across the board, right? I mean, more obviously it's sales, but even marketing or product or customers, it's all about that ownership mentality and across the whole organization.
Exactly. Yeah. And it can be hard. I really haven't run into it at Affectiva, but certainly a couple other startups. You find some people sitting in key spots in the organization, and you suddenly it's a slow dawning on them. Oh, they sound great. They're really good at analyzing the problem, but you begin to realize they never actually get anything done with that. And if the startup's going to go anywhere, you do have to make a hard choice on, you know, maybe you can find a different role where they are better suited, but more likely that it's time for them to move on.
Yeah. Anytime you factor in burn rate, I agree with the latter part, right?
Yeah. Yes.
100%. 100%. So what is one secret that you see or that you may have for driving growth, profitability, or success of your company?
Yeah, I think it's one of our secrets is to be true to our core, true to who we are. When we're doing where we're delivering emotion AI and we're working with partners or, you know, large firms or whatever to bring our expertise to bear on solving a real problem that they have or their customers have, we do great. When we start getting into we're something more than that. You know, oh, we could be the market research agency. Oh, maybe we can cobble together a panel. Oh, that kind of stuff. That's when we lose our way. So the secret of our success is to stay true to our core. We are an emotion AI company. We want to be the world's expert in humanizing technology and helping machines understand and adapt to human emotion. And that has to be our focus. There's all sorts of adjacent opportunities that would drag us off focus. And I'm not saying that those aren't legitimate strategies for some other company, but that's not what Affectiva is about. So the secret to our success in emotion AI is staying on point. And it hasn't been perfect. We've definitely sort of moved around a little bit and tried a few things off. And that's just reinforced my belief in stay to your core. Focus on your core. I'd say, you know, parenthetically, the hard part in a startup is you want to really be focused until you're sure that focus is wrong, right? So you, startups do pivot. You have to be open. You have to keep your eyes open. And even when we say, you know, we're really, really focused on market research, you know, we had to keep our eyes open for where the other markets were going. And that has helped. So but as a core strategy, even when you say it's emotion, that still leaves you lots of possible places to focus. So for us, we want to be true to emotion AI.
Not only does that clarity create, you know, or that clarity benefit the organization from a trade-off of where you spend time and treasure, but it also creates channel clarity for your customers so that, you know, whether you're servicing Miller, Brown, or Pepsi, neither feel threatened.
Exactly. I think that sort of clarity, and we've explained. I mean, I've had that conversation explaining it to some very large brands, and they appreciate the clarity, and they like, I understand how I get done when I need to get done. So they're not looking for some confused, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. And it, I think it also helps them, you know, some of these large partners, large brands have ended up at relatively small partners, but it still helps them that, you know, there's a nice young market research firm called Protobrand doing really great. We've just been partnering with them for a few months, and we love it when they win deals because it's a passionate agency that wants to be an agency, wants to provide the insights, work closely with the brands. And that works really well for us. And I think it works, as you say, it gives simplicity and clarity to the brand of who's doing what.
See, and what happened right here, I want to just take just a moment to highlight this for our audience because it's so subtle and so important. The way that I got Decipher's largest customer, who is still, incidentally, I believe, the largest customer, is by doing what you just did, which was promoting their business in conjunction or even ahead of my own. And in so doing, you bridge, and I'm gonna tie this all the way back to the beginning, right? You start building or forging these relationships that are mutually beneficial, not just now, but it's like compounded interest, and you just create a time machine where you go forward 1,000 years. It's a very powerful tool, and I'm surprised that more people don't do that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I've been at a couple of firms whose strategy ended up giving them a channel conflict, and you know, I mean early on, I think we were considering a path that someone created a channel clock and people were kind of poo-pooing. It's like, oh, well, there's also a way to work around it. But it's actually really hard. I mean, because the channel conflicts, when they exist, are fundamental, right? Let's say I'm trying to pitch Pepsi against Kantar. I mean, that's an insane place for me to be. And you can't work around it, because fundamentally, in the end, a Pepsi's going to pick somebody, right? And whoever loses isn't going to be terribly pleased about it. So sometimes you have to have a pretty clean foundation of that does not have that conflict in it. And then there's a lot of things you have to do to build on top of it.
So what is Affectiva offering right now that is getting purchased in the marketing research space?
Yeah, we call it Affectiva for Market Research, or MR. And that is basically a quantitative solution for understanding the emotional reaction to video content. It's often maybe predominantly used for advertising, but it's also being used for much for long form content. Let's give a shout out to The Good Doctor, which is a TV pilot that we tested. And because I happened to watch the test, I'm not a fan of the show. It's quantitative testing of video content. We've done 35,000 plus of these. Our science and the norms that are derived from the science are based on over 7 million people interacting with video content, 87 countries, 25% of the Fortune 500, and now an increasing number of TV studios and networks are using it to analyze their content. And essentially what happens is there's no using our stuff or not using our stuff. If you're just doing a survey, there's no change. The only difference is your panelists, and we parenthetically, we strongly believe in informed consent. The panelists are asked to opt in for emotion AI. In market research, people call it facial coding, so I will use that term going forward for facial coding. And then while they're watching the ad, your branded content, your TV episode, your movie trailer, they're recorded and their emotions and expressions are measured. This is then presented back quantitatively in two major ways. There's scores, various summary scores that attempt to summarize how joyous they were or how confused they were or their overall engagement with the ad, but also a moment-by-moment trace where you can synchronize along with the video and say, okay, here's a joke that was made, this ad built to a joke, and look at this, males love the joke, females are turned off by the joke. Did we mean to do that? I mean, usually probably not. And so you can be informed moment by moment as well as in the overall effectiveness. All these are then tied to norms based on that database of over 35,000 tests run. And we can relate those norms and also norms plus cognitive norms from the survey side and tell you how they relate to sales lift and brand recall, shared media. And the good news is your intuition about how emotion and sales lift should be related is actually true. So there isn't a big counterintuitive case to be made here. It turns out that if people are positively engaged, particularly when your brand is on the screen or when the brand reveal occurs, that's a good sign for a sales lift. And neutral engagement is and negative engagement is obviously negative, you know, reaction, I should say, is obviously poor. And this is more subtlety. So this technology is designed to embed along and work with the methodology that your market research agency uses today. We don't require any particular methodology or any particular platform or any type of panel. We've worked with hundreds of agencies over the years. Almost certainly the platform that you're on as an agency, we're already integrated with. If not, you know, our professional services organization can take you through that in a very small number of days.
I love that. Very, very valuable. Are you picking up the like voice in terms, or the Amazon effect in terms of market adoption? You get the question. I did a bad job of articulating it.
Yeah, well, because I don't know if it's a bad job, but it sort of raises two questions. So one I want to touch on is the importance of privacy. And I think anyone who does business in Europe knows GDPR came online in April, and you know, we and presumably everybody else is fully GDPR certified. So you have to be very. So one thing it begins with is, you know, everyone has informed consent about what you're doing with their data and how it's used, and then of course you have the right to be forgotten, and that you're only going to use it for the need saying. By and large, we don't look at voice in quantitative ad testing, which is. One, because they're not expected to say anything, so there really isn't much going on in the voice channel. And two, from a privacy point of view, so we actually drop the audio out. Just it's, you know, it's obviously more private to never have something you don't need. However, we have done a few qualitative studies, and our technology is used for online interviewing. And obviously, in both those cases, people understand that the voice channel is being measured, and that's a very interesting area. I think it's a potential. Growth area for us as our combined voice and face capability gets deeper and broader. It's a bit we're much earlier on with that than we are with the face only offerings. But I think in terms of understanding what's going on when people are talking, you know, obviously we relate back to those statistics. The voice is extremely important.
Yeah, makes sense. So, I tell you, I could honestly, I know we're approaching the end of the time. This is hard for me to stop because this is a lot to unpack right now, because, you know, as you just said, voice is really important, and voice is becoming more and more important especially in the context of the new purchase journey brought to us by Google Home, etc. It's just vital that this is emotional connection is a pivotal part of any successful brand strategy. So anyway, thank you, Tim, very much for being on the show. My guest today has been Tim Peacock, COO of Affectiva. Tim, thank you for being on the Happy Market Research Podcast.
It's my pleasure. Happy to do it.
Next time on the Happy Market Research Podcast, I'll be interviewing Rudy Nadillo, president of Deprassi. We'll be covering the early days of how he and Toby found their product market fit here in North America, as well as making some really unusual but important connections between photography and the visualization of data in a meaningful storytelling-based way.